in his book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, before he can prescribe possible pathways for that healing, Parker Palmer describes what's broken and how it might have come to be that way. Something happened on the way to the modern era, he says. Many Americans seem to believe that this nation's entire reason for being is to secure such a self-contained, private realm that we can pursue our own happiness without regard to the needs of others, even at their expense. Now, our loyalty today and our sense of duty may extend somewhat beyond ourselves to our children or our spouse, maybe a few others, but in any case, it is usually a relatively small circle. And this is a problem, Palmer says, because democracy requires the opposite. It requires an ever-expanding sense of loyalty, a devotion not only to what's good for me and mine, but more importantly, a sense of duty to the common good. What's good for us and ours. For the first part of her life, the 19th century writer Julia Ward Howe was a great example of what Parker Palmer critiques in the U.S. today. Her attention and energy was devoted almost entirely to her nuclear family and a few close friends. She was married to an older man, a physician, who expected her obedience and fulfillment of traditional gendered roles for the time. She was a mother to four children and an aspiring writer, and she had a certain resistance to anything that would call into question the values of her life. But then things started to change. See, Howe wasn't just a regular old Unitarian, as I described earlier, but specifically she attended a church led by the spiritually and socially radical Unitarian minister Theodore Parker. He was a great and rousing preacher who often inspired transformation in his congregation. His messages focused on social reform and abolition. And he called his community to a faith in the universal spirit that would connect all people. So Howe's faith and the studies that she took up as a result, and then the people that she met through her church, all of these began to draw her towards a more expansive understanding of life in what she described as a series of conversion experiences. And perhaps the most significant of these conversions happened in 1868, which again, that's about 7 years or so after she wrote her famous battle hymn. She was in New York City. She was a delegate for a Unitarian conference there. And while she was there, she decided, to attend a women's suffrage meeting. She wasn't totally sure about it, but she decided because a lot of her Unitarian friends would be there, and in fact, many of them would be speaking, she decided to go for it. See, up until that point, she'd been pretty negative about those who were working for women's rights. As she said it, during the first two-thirds of my life, I looked to the masculine ideal of character as the only true one. But there, listening to her friends, these people who shared her faith and who she deeply admired, including the indomitable Lucy Stone, who had taken up the bold step of keeping her maiden name even after she was married. Listening to all of them, she just had a big epiphany. She realized that all of her prior beliefs were in fact prejudices. As she says, in an unexpected hour, a new light came to me, showing a world of thought and of character quite beyond the limits I had hitherto been content to abide. The new domain now made clear to me was that of true womanhood. Woman, no longer an ancillary reaction to an opposite, man, but in her direct relation to the divine purpose and plan, as a free agent, fully sharing every human right and every human responsibility. She left that gathering in 1868, declaring to the suffragists, "I am with you." And they, in turn, elected her president of the New England Women's Suffrage Association. House feminism, as I said earlier, was expansive. It called her to advocate, not just for women's rights, but for peace and for an end to poverty, for compassion for those convicted of crimes, for racial equality. And I have to believe that this expansiveness was the direct result of her growing faith that we are all connected and one human family, so that her sense of duty could no longer be directed just at her own children or her own family, but instead she felt this deep connection to all of the world's children and their mothers, all as one family. This global sense of duty brought Howe to Europe in 1872, where I said earlier she'd been invited to help found an international women's peace congress. She spoke all over London and the surrounding areas while she was there, sometimes as lectures, but just as often as preaching and leading worship, including in an appeal to the Unitarian Association. Finally, she went to the Peace Congress in Paris, which was the original reason for her trip. They had told her that's where she could begin to make headway at her new idea, but there she was turned away because she was a woman. Despite this setback, she described the trip actually as a great success because she could feel in a sense of partnership in all those places where she did get to speak, and so she was hopeful. She could see that it was possible that we could all hear the cries of the world's children as if they were our own. It was possible to imagine a world driven and shaped by the dreams of mothers, to treat all people as the beloved children of mothers who would do whatever they can so that their children could experience abundant life. Julia Ward Howe spent the rest of her life dedicated to making this vision a reality. As I said before, it was after that trip she came back and began to talk about new strategies, including founding the Mother's Day for Peace and writing her proclamation. But for much of this time of her life, she realized that she would not live to see all of this vision a reality. Still, she persisted. Rather than simply working on behalf of her generation's children or grandchildren, whose lives would see some but still not enough progress, she began to take up that task that Scott admonished us towards two Sundays ago, to envision herself an ancestor of all the generations that were yet to come. Our ancestors, in fact, who would inherit the world that she worked for. And we do. And we are grateful. Still, I have to believe there would be pieces of our world today, maybe big pieces, that would grieve Julia Ward Howe, and terribly. A few weeks ago, as the news reported that our country had dropped, quote, the mother of all bombs, you may have heard Pope Francis critique the use of the word mother to describe such destruction. Then I thought regretfully of Julia Ward Howe. She, with this great vision for motherhood that would save us all from destruction, a mother of all people. Although our world has changed in so many good ways, Howe's call to rise up and resist the forces of division, destruction, and violence feels as timely as ever. It's just perhaps not so likely to come by way of a Mother's Day brunch, as nice as that may be. Which brings me to the image on the front of your order of service today. You'll likely recognize behind the quote a few, at least maybe one of the women there, or get what the image is pointing to. These are three of the mothers of the movement for Black Lives. Gwen Carr, mother of Eric Garner, Leslie McSpadden in the middle, mother of Michael Brown, and Sabrina Fulton on the end, mother of Trayvon Martin. Since these and the other mothers of the movement have lost their children in police shootings, often without any resulting accountability, They have raised their voices just as mothers have been doing generation to generation. In Howe's words from her proclamation, "Arise, all people who have hearts. Our sons shall not be taken from us. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice." These women and others like them continue the work of Julia Ward Howe and Anna Reeves and the many other progressive activists of the past, calling us to hear their cries as mothers longing for hope for their children. Now, whether we're talking about the movement for Black lives or for immigrant rights, the still needed call for peace or for prison reform or for health care, so often we weigh these ideas based on the theoretical strategy or the specific details of a given narrative, the pros and cons, the pace of how to get what done and when. But all of these can keep us hesitant, unsure, in our heads, and keeps us treating all of these things as if they are separate considerations. But when we remember that the people involved are someone's children, with mothers, and even more when we hear the cries of their mothers as if they are our own cries, as if these are actually our children, then all these details become a lot less important. And we start to see them all as one. And this is when we have hope of yielding to Julia Ward Howe's vision. When there is no one who is not ours. No one of this generation or of the generations to come, then not only does democracy work better, like Parker Palmer surmises, but more importantly, we, like Julia Ward Howe at the Women's Rights Convention in New York, might find ourselves standing before the whole world and saying, "I am with you, and you might just elect us president." So in honor of Julia Ward Howe and the original vision for Mother's Day, I'm going to invite us now into a new Mother's Day proclamation. Sean and I are going to alternate between words of contemporary stories that are aligned with those original visions, and then I will read words that are directly from her proclamation. We invite you to participate with us. There's a response in your order of service. I'm going to cue you, in case it's not totally clear when your part is, with something like this. Okay. Let us begin.
Guided by the examples of mothers and others who resist violence, division, and oppression, and who heed the call of courageous love, let us declare together a new Mother's Day proclamation. And let us commit ourselves to the path of resilience and resistance, justice and joy.
Arise then, all who have hearts, whether overflowing with life's beauty or broken open by despair.
Today's mothers of the movement, like Lucia McBath, mother of Jordan Davis, murdered at age 17, remind us that you don't stop being a parent when your child dies. Their love for their children compels us to take action, urges us to acknowledge that Black lives matter, and to rectify the legacy of persecution that led to the deaths of their children, deaths that continue today.
Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided for us by irrelevant agencies. Our loved ones will not come to us reeking of carnage for caresses or applause. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, "Disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice."
May this be our resolution, in heart and in practice.
We follow the lead of Jeanette Vizguerra and other immigrant mothers who have sacrificed so much for their children and their families, and who call us to transform immoral and unjust laws. We commit to communities unbound by the whims of xenophobia or the ancient and strong wrong impulse to blame the stranger, the marginalized, the poor. We insist together on the dignity of all.
We, with hearts for our own children, will be too tender to the hearts of mothers of other children in other neighborhoods and other countries to allow our children to be trained to injure theirs.
May this be our resolution. 17 years ago, this very weekend, over 750,000 mothers showed up on Washington's National Mall, and then thousands of others in capitals across the country, all raising their voices in support of stricter gun control as part of the Million Mom March. Organized without the tools of today's social media, it was a true grassroots movement, born out of a mother's heartbreak. Today, this work has been taken up by Mothers Demand Action for Gun Sense, which Imam convened in the response to the devastating shootings at Sandy Hook.
Why do not the mothers of humankind interfere and prevent the waste of human life which they alone bear and know the cost? Our children shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience.
May this be a resolution in heart and in practice. On January 21st of this year, 2017, over 5 million people across the globe took to the streets as part of the Women's March, a movement started in response to the anti-woman statements and policies of the new U.S. president. Started by just a few, within a short week, it became one of the largest international protest events the world has ever seen.
Arise, all who have hearts. Though we too often forsake our common good and follow selfish concerns, let us leave behind the illusion of division. Let us commit to a steadfast practice of sustained counsel and covenant with one another and all the people of the world. Let us acknowledge the irreparable harm done sibling to sibling, and let us grieve our losses. Rising out of this anguish, we look to what may still be repaired and even begun again.
May this be our resolution in heart and in practice.
We look to these mothers to lead us. Mothers of the movement, immigrant mothers, Mothers Demand Action, the diverse leaders of the Women's March, and all those who participate. We look to learn from those and all of the many who, even in their deepest grief and despair and fear, lead us to remember that we belong to each other.
In the name of humanity, let a solemn and joyful collaboration begin. In lieu of a day or a moment of commitment honoring our mothers, let us cultivate a new habit of reconciliation, wholeness, and unity. In this way, may the great human family live in peace.
May this be our resolution
in heart and in practice.
Amen.